Welcome to the Lance On Podcast. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about heaven. Now, I'm assuming you want to go there considering the other option, but do you know anything about what's waiting for you there? Heaven is mentioned all the time in sermons and TV shows and songs, but finding any solid clues on what it's actually like is really difficult. But that's why we're going to talk about it, right? This is the Lance On Podcast.
What are the fruits of the Spirit?
How do I hear God's voice?
I want you to understand God.
How do we use and understand the Bible?
What if I feel hurt by the church?
Let's come together.
What's heaven like?
Let's talk about it.
This is the Lance On Podcast.
As we begin, I want to remind you that Season 4 is built to have new episodes released every Tuesday on Access More. So make sure you subscribe now so you don't have to search it out. It just drops right in your podcast list. And remember, if you love this podcast and truly want to bless me, rate and review it on whatever platform you get your podcast from. So let's blow this podcast up. Amen? All right. Good, good, good. I am fired up today, and I want to talk about heaven. To be honest, as much as I want to go there, I'm not all that excited to get there today. And most of the reason why is because I don't know enough about it to look forward to it. In fact, the whole reason I want to go is because my God is there. I don't care too much about rest of the details if I get to be with Him forever. Being with Him is the whole goal of my life. But there's nothing wrong with taking a deep dive into the Bible and seeing if there's any clues we can find out about what it's going to be like. Going anywhere new can be adventurous or scary. And sometimes the difference is knowing a little bit about our destination. So let's see what we can find out. Maybe it's worth asking the question right off the top. Why do you want to know more about heaven? I told you why I am. So are you interested in this stuff for the stuff? For the environment? Are you interested in what you get? Or are you asking because you want to know what to look forward to? Is there any chance that you're a bit nervous about it and you're hoping that I'm going to make it a bit more familiar? Well, whatever your reason, I think that our motivation for studying the subject matters. If we're only interested in what we get, then perhaps we have this whole thing backward. Heaven is heaven because God is there. Hell is hell because God is not. Heaven isn't heaven because of the cool things or the cool abilities we would get. Hell isn't terrible because we're bored or being tortured. The very essence of any meaning of heaven and hell has to do with the presence of God. So maybe we should start there, yeah? The Bible says that God dwells in the heavens. Well, kind of. What the Bible is really trying to convey is that God can't be contained here on earth or in our universe or anywhere, to be honest. The whole point of talking in terms of heaven biblically is to use familiar language about somewhere wonderful. And the reason it's wonderful is that the Creator, the author of life, the essence of all that is good, dwells there. The longing for heaven is not just the satiation of our longing souls, but the joy of being joined to our God that we have pursued through faith in this life. We came from God, and in God is the only place that we make sense. Apart from Him, we shrivel up and die. He's the source of happiness and laughter and joy and peace and thriving. He's the one that fashioned us in our mother's womb. He's the one that saved us and the one that knows our thoughts before we do. He's the one that holds us when we cry and is the ultimate adventure guide. He is creative and awesome. And heaven is His dwelling place. So if we desire anything good, anything right, anything perfect, anything powerful, it's going to be found near Him. And that's what's so wonderful about heaven. Now, having said all that, I promised you at the top of the show to dig into the Bible to talk about what it shares with us about what heaven is like. Because we're told that God's children are going to spend eternity there. In other words, we step out of time and into a whole new reality, a whole new dimension that is never ending. Which, by the way, that concept of forever is a little trippy, don't you think? I remember being a kid, and my mind was frying off that for a while. And to be honest, it was kind of anxiety-inducing. It sounded so long and so tiring. I couldn't imagine not being able to sleep forever and keep going. And I thought about how my brain would be so overloaded. My imagination made it seem so unpeaceful. Now, oddly enough, when my second daughter was very young, she went through the same process. Now, thankfully, I was older and wiser and more studied. So when she asked me about it and told me how much it freaked her out, I was able to give her some perspective and peace. And what I told her, and remember, she was super young, is that it was like a worm. Imagine a worm being told that he was going to be transferred one day to the realm of the human beings. He would have to have a job and pay bills and taxes. He would have a family and need to provide and care for them. He'd have to go to school. He'd have to learn to drive a car. All that would be so scary to him. He couldn't ever imagine living for 90 years and doing all that stuff. He would get overwhelmed immediately. But we do all that stuff, and it seems so normal to us. Some of that stuff we actually thrive in and long to do. Instead of being a burden or something we fear, we dream about getting married, about having kids, about having a meaningful job. So what is overwhelming to a worm is normal to us. We don't even think twice about it. Why? Because we are built for our world, and he's built for his. His limitations and resources don't work in ours, so it wouldn't make sense. In the same way, a heavenly, eternal existence will be normal, healthy, joyful, and fun once we're built for it. Our resources and limitations that we operate off in this dimension don't work there, and they don't make any sense. We think in terms of tiredness and decay and decrease and time, but that's not there. We don't know what it's like to live in a world where we don't suffer loss. We don't know what it's like to not have to shut down every night to keep running. We don't know what it's like to be peaceful in our mind and not get overloaded. We aren't built for it yet. But once we are, it will be as normal as our reality is today. And that brings me to another really important concept I think we need to factor into our understanding of heaven, and that is familiarity. On one hand, we know that God is infinitely creative and can do anything he dreams up. Yet, on the other hand, when we look at God's creation so far, there's something oddly familiar and similar about them. Think about the angelic world. Remember, we weren't the first go-round with God creating sentient beings. Before we were made, there was a whole race of beings in a dimension outside of this one. The Bible talks about being a dynamic world of free will choices and beauty and rebellion and so many other familiar realities. As much as it's weird to think of what a cherubim may look like or how powerful Michael the Archangel is, no matter how elusive an image of a demon might be, there are some really familiar elements to their dimension. For example, they have form. Think about that for a second. There is nothing in the Bible that says that angels and demons are omnipresent everywhere at the same time. In fact, it says quite the opposite. Consider the fact that even Jesus Christ, the second person of the Trinity, the eternal one, took his body with him when he rose from the grave. So what does that mean about our next and heavenly existence? Well, it certainly means that we don't dissipate into ethereal clouds of gas or become one collective bodiless mind, right? Now, quite frankly, there are stories, like the Witch of Endor story in 1 Samuel 28, that indicate that even in the afterlife, we are recognizable to some degree. Now, that's a bummer if we're ugly. Now, I'm hoping God will do a little nip-tuck move on each of us and let us be the best version of ourselves. Otherwise, well, I need to get in the gym more. All right, but let that soak in for a moment. The familiarity of how the Bible talks about angelic existence. They're in a location. They see stuff. They can say stuff. They can feel stuff. We know about all of that. It's not like the new dimension is so off the charts bizarre that we can't even begin a discussion, right? In all of God's creativity, he certainly could do that, but he doesn't. Why? I think it's because he wants it that way, and it allows a beautiful ability to have relationship and community. So let's follow that line of thinking for a moment. Jesus took his body with him. When he showed back up to the disciples after the resurrection, they recognized him, well, most of the time, and they could even see and feel the nail marks in his hands. He still had a body, and although it was glorified and he could appear and disappear and seemingly walk through walls, it was familiar. He still roughly had the same shape. It wasn't like he was suddenly a glowing orb of blue and red lights that flickered in and out of existence and a disembodied voice whispered in their brains. Okay, clearly, I have a bizarre imagination and I watch way too much TV. But, okay, let's just keep going. What does it mean that Jesus has a body like maybe forever? Well, it means that there needs to be a dimension created for our future where bodies make sense. And that's where we see these concepts in the Bible, like a new heavens and a new earth in Revelation 21 come into play. There's something familiar about the concept of a new earth. Now, I don't know how the new heaven and new earth interact, right? Maybe it's like a big Disneyland monorail that goes back and forth with Moses' voice on the speakers. Welcome to Hebrew Parking Lot 1. Remember to keep your arms and legs inside the vehicle at all times. Well, obviously, I don't think that. But I do think that just as there are locations and dimensions that interact like today with heavens and earth, so too do I think that we're able to interact with them in the future. Even if the new heavens and new earth are temporary or symbolic, the point is still real. There's a location-based concept. That's familiar. Paul the Apostle got a ton of questions about what our bodies would be like in the afterlife, and he obviously got enough to address the question rather extensively in 1 Corinthians 15. He explains that although they're going to be different, we're going to have bodies like Jesus, which we just talked about being rather familiar. We know for sure that we will be changed, and that flesh and blood, or the limited version of us here, isn't built for there. Just the sheer demand of immortality requires some upgrades, right? And we know from John's revelation that the things that hurt us here will be removed. He talks about Jesus wiping away our tears. He talks about there being no more death, no more mourning, no more pain. All of that requires a lot of adjustments to our current bodily reality. It's awesome, but we're built right now for pain and sorrow. There's no more need for those concerns. So obviously, there are a lot of adjustments in a glorified body. We don't need to worry that our limitations here are going to limit us there. God knows what we need, and he knows what he needs to build. Now, although we're going to be glorified and new, we will still have enough familiar to know it's us and to know other people. Now, interestingly, throughout the years, I've got far more questions about whether we will be able to recognize our loved ones way more than I ever get questions about what heaven is like. Nobody ever asks me what heaven is like. And the reason why is I think that in our grief of loss of a loved one, we desperately want to know that we will see them again, and not just a bizarre version of them, but the version that we loved so much. But I also think the same thing goes for our loved ones that are still with us. We want to know that we will continue to have relationship with them. Now, scriptures in Matthew and Mark record Jesus talking about what it will be relationally like in heaven. And as he talks to the Sadducee group, a religious organization, he told them that we would not be married in heaven. Now, of course, that is quite unsettling for those of us who deeply love our spouses. But I think it's important that Jesus didn't say anything about not being connected in a powerful way. He merely said that there would not be a need for a restraining covenant like marriage in order to have safety. I truly believe that in heaven, we won't have any of the terrible blocks to intimacy like that we have due to sin here on earth. I believe that our relational connections to people will be like Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden when they were naked, unashamed, and unafraid. I think that the level of intimacy with our partners and loved ones will be far superior to anything we know today. Marriage doesn't define our love, but I fully understand the unsettling nature of a change like that. What I do know is that when God is done with his fresh new design, none of us will be disappointed with the results. All right, and then there's a matter of what the stuff will look like in heaven. I know it shouldn't matter, but our curiosity always gets the best of us, doesn't it? What about the pearly gates, the streets of gold, the mansions? Is that stuff legit? Well, interestingly, the vast majority of the information we've heard through the years describing what we think of as our heavenly dwelling place is found in Revelations chapters 20 and 21, and they surround descriptions of what's called the New Jerusalem. Apparently, John saw it as part of the new redesign of the new heavens and new earth that we talked about earlier. The New Jerusalem is a city, but it's described as a type of bride for Jesus Christ. It's described by the angel, it's described as one giant cube city. It's stunningly beautiful. It has massively high walls with 12 gates, and each gate is made from a single pearl. The city was made of pure, transparent gold, while the walls are made of jasper. God himself provides the illumination for the city, so there's no need for sun or moon, and it never gets dark. And in the center is the river of life flowing from the throne of God, and on its banks is a tree of life. It's these descriptions that give us those thoughts of pearly gates and streets of gold. The problem with that is I don't think it describes our heavenly dwelling at all. The first clue is it's called the Bride of Christ. The only other clear reference to the Bride of Christ in the Bible is the church, the people of God. I believe that the Holy Jerusalem doesn't talk about the heavenly city that we're going to live in as much as it's describing the state of God's people in his presence. And here's another thing. Think through the description again for a moment. Why are there high walls and gates if all sin and bad guys are gone? Right? I understand it says the gates stay open, but still, why do you have gates? And why are there 12 foundations for it? Is there going to be like a huge earthquake? Doesn't it seem suspicious to you that the foundations are named after the apostles and the gates are named after the 12 tribes of Israel? And to be honest, is the cube really big enough for everyone to live there? And does that mean that in order to fit, we all need to be able to float so people can live up and down as well as side to side? And come to think of it, wouldn't gold streets be super slippery in the rain? And what if I want to go rollerblading in short shorts and... Right? At some point, it becomes odd and absurd. No, I don't think we're seeing a literal description of a city we'll live in as much as we're seeing God's magnificent glorification of his beloved people. And what about the whole we all get mansions thing? You've heard that one, right? Where did that come from? Well, unfortunately, it largely comes from a mistranslation in the King James Version of the Bible of John 14:2. The King James Version says, "In my Father's house are many mansions, and I go to prepare a place for you there." But a better, more accurate translation would read, "In my Father's house are many rooms, and I go to prepare a place for you." The key difference is the term mansion versus room. Mansion gives the impression that there will be separate, isolating houses which we picture along a street of gold. But many rooms in one large house of God creates a very different image, one of people living together in community, yet still having uniqueness. That's the room thing. The sad thing is that when we improperly combine these false images with a concept of heavenly rewards being given to believers, we end up this bogus picture of a big row of massive mansions, each given to individuals for good stuff they've done, each hoping their mansion is bigger than the others. I think that image has more to do with selfish entitlement than it has to do with any biblical description. Now, of course, yes, rewards in heaven are real. No, we don't really know what they are. Yes, God talks about how our actions here impact our initial reality there, and that when we are responsible here, we're given more responsibility there. Yes, the parable of the minas uses the phrase, "You will be given authority over cities." Upon first glance, right, that kind of almost reinforces the mansions theory, but that's not what it says. What it indicates is that we will have things to do in heaven. We will have purpose in heaven. We will have advancement concepts. But no, it doesn't speak to us getting fancy things to lord over other people or to parade around in pride. Now, one of the other complicating factors is that many of our assumptions about heaven have to do with passages that are intended to describe what's called the millennial kingdom during the thousand-year reign of Christ. Now, I realize some scholars don't believe in a literal earthly reign of Christ, but we cannot deny that those descriptions found in passages like in Revelation 20 may not be about heaven. Without getting too far in the weeds, I'll explain it this way. The millennial kingdom is the thousand-year period after Satan is bound, pulled out of the way, and before the final battle where God puts an end to Satan and his team once and for all, throwing them and all non-believers into the lake of fire forever. It's this delayed, glorious moment before the final end. Okay, that period where Satan's influence is removed is considered a time of peace and a time of blessing. Now, this is a huge deal for the Jewish people historically. The Jews look forward to it as a time when they would finally be ruled by the Messiah, and they would be exalted to a prominent place on earth, getting their promised blessings that they heard so much about in the Old Testament. That period is described as a time when the lion would lay down with the lamb, and there would be peace among the nations, and God would be well known and worshiped throughout the earth. Now, that all sounds great, and it sure sounds like heaven, and in fact, to make matters worse, one of the major passages describing it is found in Isaiah 65, and it says that it's describing, quote, "the new heavens and new earth," end quote. Doesn't that sound familiar? Weren't we just talking about that in a heaven description way? We were. But again, we have some clues that this is not heaven that we're talking about. In verse 20 of Isaiah 65, describing this period, this new heavens, new earth, it talks about the inhabitants living a long time, but it doesn't talk about them living forever. It also talks about sinners being around, which we know don't get to be in heaven. So clearly, it's talking about something else. So what does all of this mean? I've pointed out like all these passages that we think are about heaven but aren't. So what do we know about heaven from the Bible? Well, that's the thing, not much. As I've explained all along, we get concepts, but we don't get a lot of descriptions. It's like the Bible's descriptions of the throne room of God and depictions of cherubim and seraphim, you know, where it says holy, 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 and they're surrounding the throne, and they're like, they had multiple faces and multiple wings, and then these were the fiery ones, like all that stuff. I don't think they really look like that. I think those are symbolic descriptions of their nature. Like they're covered with eyes, meaning they're always aware. Right? They have multiple heads, meaning they can see in different positions from different perspectives, stuff like that. In all passages like the ones that we've studied, we don't usually get actual details, but we do get precious insights. More simply said, after all of my examination of heaven in the Bible, I may not be able to know the street color of heaven or what the new earth looks like, but I can know this. Heaven will be glorious. Heaven will have God. Heaven will be both shockingly new and fresh, yet comfortably familiar. Heaven will be full of adventure and challenge, learning and purpose. Heaven will allow full usage of our glorified bodies. Heaven will be filled with many people we know and love. Heaven will be about relationship just as much as earth has been. Heaven will be a place of peace, joy, and health. I may not know everything I want to know about heaven, but as long as God and my loved ones are there, everything else is just details. This is the Lance Hahn Podcast.